Hello everyone, how are you all doing? Welcome to Blood Runs Cold, the true crime podcast, looking at cases from around the world involving murder, missing persons, miscarriages of justice and more. I am Peter, creator and host of this podcast, and in this episode, episode 6, I'm going to go back to 1992 to look at the unsolved murder of Natalie Pearman in Norwich. Before we get going, I'd just like to say thank you to anyone who's listened to any of the previous episodes. Remember, you can give us a follow on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, /X, whatever you want to call it. Also, it would be great if you could leave us a positive review on whichever podcast platform you're listening on. Or, if you're listening on YouTube, please hit the like button, subscribe to the channel and comment. And let us know what I'm doing right and what I'm doing wrong. Anyway, let's get on with the episode. So, Natalie Pearman, she was born on Christmas Day in 1975 and she grew up in Munsley, a coastal village just over 20 miles northeast of Norwich in Norfolk. It's a quiet village with a population of under 3,000 people, with the majority of those being the older generation. And while it may be a popular seaside holiday destination, it can't have been the most exciting place for a young girl to grow up. She lived in a council house with her mum Lynn, her stepdad Chris and her four siblings. She enjoyed ballet, horse riding and art. She was good at drawing and painting and apparently she had a dream to travel the world. And in order to do so, she wanted to join the Air Force. Her biological father, Rod, had split up with her mum when Natalie was just a year old. And when she was 12, her mum got pregnant and was extremely unwell throughout the pregnancy. So Chris had to quit his job to care 24/7 for her. And then he couldn't find any more work afterwards. So that put quite a strain on the family. They were a little bit skint, Chris weren't working, so sacrifices had to be made. And this meant Natalie had to give up the things she loved doing, including ballet, horse riding, and the trips with the brownies that she enjoyed. So it was kind of hard on her. When she was 14, she got a job in a burger bar in Munsley to earn some extra money for herself. And it was around this time that she started hanging out at a bus stop with some local lads. She was seeing an older boy from Yarmouth, and he apparently brought and supplied her with cannabis. In my research, I read that she was said to have seemingly changed overnight from a skinny, mousy schoolgirl to a willowy blonde, and she also no longer wanted to be known as Natalie. She wanted to be called Maria. Apparently, she would disappear, she'd go out drinking alcohol, taking drugs, and I even saw something that says she was arrested for breaking and entering and for car theft. In an attempt to snap her out of this phase or whatever it was, her mum tried a bit of tough love with her, telling her she needed to stop doing drugs or that she would have to leave the family home. Natalie told her mum she wasn't doing drugs, she was just enjoying herself and having a bit of fun. She then met a 17-year-old and she got pregnant. Natalie had a plan that the boy would move into the family home and Lynn would look after the baby while the young couple went out to work. This caused several arguments in the house and then Natalie threatened to leave and move in with her friend, but the boy done a runner and Natalie sadly miscarried. There were issues in the family home around that time anyway. Lynn had had a miscarriage of her own around the same time as Natalie did. Natalie's brother was sent to the Falklands and her grandmother, or step-grandmother, Chris's mum, was diagnosed with cancer. Natalie started rebelling even more than she already had. She was staying out all night and Chris often had to go out and find her to bring her home. Sometimes the police even had to get involved. One particular night after the police took her home, Lynn apparently slapped Natalie and chased her all over the house with a slipper. Her parents tried to talk to her to find out what was happening, but she weren't listening to what they had to say. So they resorted to locking her in the house in a bid to stop the rebellion. This didn't work though, as Natalie would escape through the cat flap. Eventually it all became a little bit too much for the family and social services were called in. Natalie told the social services she wanted to go into care and they were not sure if it was just a teen acting out or if there was some sort of underlying abuse. Natalie then started dating a farm worker called Simon and she spent a lot of time with his friends smoking and breaking into homes, basically continuing the bad behaviour her parents had tried to stop, and she was even cautioned a few times by the police. She complained to the social services that her stepfather was too hard on her, and she even hinted at a possibility of abuse having taken place, but she refused to give details. However, one night, there was a particularly nasty argument and her stepfather slapped her. The next day, she proudly showed Simon her bruise and said she didn't want to go back home. The police later found her walking alone along the beach, but when the police tried to return her to the family home, Lynn refused to have her back in the house. She basically said she had caused far too much trouble, she had fallen pregnant, she was doing drugs, she wasn't showing her parents any respect, and her mother didn't want her back in the house. So, less than 6 months after Natalie had turned 14 years old, she was in care. Lynn said she would have Natalie home eventually, but it was down to her daughter to make the first move. Natalie said it was down to her mum to apologise though, so both were waiting on the other to take that step. When Chris's mum died, Natalie was determined to go to the funeral, despite the family saying that they didn't want her there, she wasn't welcome. Apparently, after all of her bad behaviour and the trouble she had created, her attendance at the funeral would cause too much upset. Her behaviour hadn't improved after she had left the family home either. She was even breaking the rules in the care home. She was fighting, she had started sniffing petrol, and I read somewhere that she was still taking drugs. Despite this bad behaviour, the social services took her to the funeral, where her entire family ignored her. And a short while after this, she was informed that the family wanted her to change her surname to her biological father's. Which is hard to understand, really, and it must have been really hard for her. Yeah, she had been somewhat of a bitch. She had done a lot of things you wouldn't expect most 14-year-olds to do. She had fallen pregnant, she had been taking drugs, etc, etc. But now it was like she had been completely disowned by her family. Like, a family's supposed to be there, you know, to help a child, no matter what they're going through and no matter how they're reacting or behaving. But this family seemed to just, like, push her away. But anyway, over the next year, there were periods of calm, but she was still said to be going off the rails, and the calm never lasted for long. Simon suggested they see less of each other, so she overdosed on contraceptive pills. She found a foster family, but was only there for a short time because the foster mum accused her of snorting drugs. She did try to make contact with her family, and she went to a phone box, called Chris, and asked him to come and take her home. But he took her back to the social workers instead. When she was back at the children's home, she told staff that she had taken heroin. They'd done blood tests, though, and she was proven to have either lied about it or she had taken something else and thought it was heroin. She rarely saw her family now. Lynn had a new baby by this point and refused to visit Natalie with the baby. At Christmas, Chris dropped off some presents but didn't even go in to see her. Natalie remained in care until she turned 16, and when she did turn 16, she was no longer under the care of the children's home. So, she was on her own and either staying in a room at the YWCA or sofa surfing at various friends' houses. It was around this time that she started spending time at the ferry boat pub in the middle of Norwich, which is or was a notorious red light area known as the Block. It was also around this time that she started working as a prostitute. I saw somewhere that she was charging around £30 for full sex and was making around £500 a week. She was able to splash the cash for the first time in her life, and this meant buying new clothes and stuff. And she also had a plan to buy a flash phone and a new car. But most of her money went on nights out with her friends, one of which described them dancing all night, falling out of a nightclub into a taxi, and crying with laughter. People that knew Natalie around this time, or Maria as she was now known, said that she seemed happy. She took drugs, but she wasn't addicted or dependent on them. She had apparently told people that her parents had died in a car crash when she was young, and she was just known as someone who was enjoying her youth and having fun. In November 1992, she went to see her mum. They hadn't seen each other for around about a year at this point, but she had returned to the family home to pick up her birth certificate because she wanted to get her passport sorted in order to travel to France or Spain. She told her mum that she had won the war with her past and there was nothing left for her in Norfolk. Lynn did point out to her that she would have to wait a few weeks to get the passport and noted that this seemed to make Natalie really agitated. Friends also hinted around that time that she seemed very eager to get away, and there were a number of rumours that she was running from someone. Possibly a pimp or a drug dealer or someone else. Maybe a regular customer. Nobody had any more details really, and the rumours couldn't be confirmed. Lynn later said that she barely recognised her daughter when she went to visit. She described her as heavily made up blonde standing on her doorstep, and she didn't understand most of what her daughter was talking about. There was talk of pimps and vice squad and drugs and stuff, and she described it as there seeming to be a fog of evil surrounding her daughter. Lynn also said that she was such a stranger to her that she even had to ask her how she liked her tea now. Her mother did say that the meeting had been positive, though. Natalie had given her mum her phone number and an address where she was staying, and her mum was confident this was the first step to them repairing their relationship. In a later interview, Lynn said, quote, "She was trying to make the contact with me, and I think had things not happened as they did, I think we would have had a relationship from that day on," end quote. Unfortunately, they couldn't have a relationship because just a few days later, Natalie would be dead. The last sighting of Natalie was reported to have been at around 1:15 a.m. on the 20th of November 1992 in Music House Lane, Norwich. Around midnight, so just over an hour before the last sighting of her, a taxi driver had picked Natalie slash Maria up in Tombland in Norwich and took her to Witham Park, where they spent 30 minutes together. He then said he dropped her back to the city centre. Shortly after this, a man approached her and paid her for sex in his house. At 3:50 a.m, a lorry driver on his way to work stopped in a lay-by on Ringland Road on the outskirts of Norwich and saw what he thought was a bundle of clothes laying in a woodland at Ringland Hills. As it turned out, what the lorry driver had actually found was a deceased body of Natalie Pearman. She had been stripped from the waist down and there were bruises around her neck. The location she was found was really remote, a little more than 10 miles driving distance from where Natalie was last seen. Ringland Road is just basically a long, dark road surrounded by woodland on both sides. It was a known meeting place for people wanting to meet up for sex, a dogging site as it would probably be known as now, but it wasn't the sort of place that Natalie would usually go with a client. She preferred city centre locations, places that were a little busier, somewhere she would feel safer, I suppose, especially if the rumours about her being in fear of someone were indeed true. A post-mortem later showed that her cause of death was asphyxiation and that she had been sexually assaulted. There was semen on her clothes and inside her, and her skirt was missing. The police launched the biggest inquiry in Norfolk police history. They interviewed over 4,000 people eventually and DNA profiled around 700 men. Then in 1993, they put out an appeal to trace a car with unique tyres on the front wheels and one of the rears. This was just the beginning of an investigation that is still going on to this day. The police investigation was and has been an extremely extensive one. Natalie's clients on the night of her murder were questioned, as well as anyone known to have a connection to her. Apparently, Natalie had had unprotected sex with at least three men on the night of her murder, and police believe the third and final one is her murderer, but as yet, they haven't been able to find who this person is. Inquiries haven't led them to the killer, and several more leads over the years have led nowhere. Serial killers Peter Tobin and Steve Wright have both emerged as suspects for very different reasons. In the case of Tobin, it was information from a psychic called Carol Everett that led to him being classed as a suspect. The psychic didn't specifically name him, but she sketched a man she believed was responsible for Natalie's death during one of what she called her intuitive investigations. This sketch looked remarkably similar to Tobin. Apparently, she hadn't seen a picture of Tobin before, and she didn't know any of the details of the case, so she just had a name and this is what came to her. She sent a document to the police in 1994 with several details that she believed would lead detectives to the murderer. She said the man seemed to be a political type person who was well spoken and who probably visited Natalie on more than one occasion. At the bottom of the letter, she said the name of the man could possibly be something like George Wright or Bright or something similar. So, it was just a sketch that was similar to Tobin, not any of the details in Carol's letter or anything else that she had said. But, regardless, Tobin was later ruled out as a suspect anyway in the case of Natalie, as well as other cases looked at by Norfolk Police. They carried out a full investigation in 2009, and a police spokesman said the potential link with Peter Tobin had been investigated and there was no evidence at this time to suggest a link between him and any offences in Norfolk. The Suffolk strangler, Steve Wright, emerged as a suspect after he was convicted of the murders of five sex workers in Ipswich, Suffolk in February 2008. The main reason he was named as a suspect, apart from the fact that he was a convicted serial killer who killed sex workers by strangulation, was the fact that he used to run the ferry boat inn. The pub in the heart of the Norwich Red Light District that I mentioned earlier that Natalie and other sex workers had frequented. However, this link was tenuous at best. Wright had been in charge of the pub in 1988, with his tenancy lasting for just 5 months, and he then moved down south. He lived in South East London, first in Chislehurst and then in Plumstead, and it was there that he met a barmaid by the name of Sarah Whitley and they had a baby together. Another rumour that suggested Wright could be Natalie's killer was reports that the young girl had had her body hair shaved off by the killer and the victims in Suffolk had also been shaved as well. But Natalie's mum, Lynn, was interviewed about this at the time and said it was nonsense, that neither her or the police family liaison officer had heard anything about Natalie's body hair being shaved. And the detective chief superintendent in charge of the Ipswich murders also rebuffed any reports of any of the victims having had their body hair shaved. Regardless of the reports, rumours or links, Wright was officially ruled out as a suspect in the murder of Natalie, as well as other sex workers including Kelly Pratt and Michelle Bettles, who had both disappeared from Norwich's Red Light District at different times. Kelly Pratt was last seen outside the Rose Public House in Queen's Road, Norwich on the 11th of June 2000, and her body's never been found. Michelle Bettles disappeared on the 28th of March 2002 from the same sort of area, and her body was found in Dereham, Suffolk 3 days later. She had also died of strangulation. Norfolk and Suffolk police did work together to see if Wright had anything to do with either case, but he was eventually ruled out as a suspect in all cases. There were also other joint investigations as well that looked into links between Natalie's murder and any other similar cases. Norfolk police worked with both Bristol and Strathclyde police forces looking at cases where sex workers had been strangled and dumped in lay-bys or on open ground. There were similarities between Natalie's murder and those of Carol Clark in Bristol and Karen McGregor in Glasgow, but police did also say these similarities weren't enough to link the murders. So, no suspects were ever found in either of these investigations that could be linked to Natalie's murder. It was the same with a man who was arrested in Leicestershire. He was detained for the murder of two sex workers, but again, there was no evidence to charge him. A fresh appeal in 2017, 25 years after Natalie's murder, identified at least five new persons of interest, but they were all DNA tested and ruled out on the basis that none of them were a match. It's sad that Natalie's murder has not been resolved. They've never found who killed her or the reason for it, whether it was basically just a random attack or if there was another reason. But unfortunately, hers is just one in a number of murders involving sex workers that remains unsolved to this day. During my research, I found the list on Wikipedia. And I know before you say it, Wikipedia can't be taken as gospel, but it can be used as a solid reference point and it makes for grim reading, really. looking at murders or missing persons presumed dead in cases involving sex workers from the 1980s up until 2018, it shows there are 56 unsolved cases out of 173 in total. As I said, it can't be taken as fact, but the list does show that the last unsolved case was in 2006. So, if we look at cases from the 80s up until 2006, there were around 130 cases, with 56 of those unsolved. This is 43%, almost half, and that's a high percentage of cases unsolved. If you look back through history, sex workers, drug users, homeless people, they do seem to be seen as an easy target when it comes to killers, especially serial killers. Murderers such as Dennis Nilsen and Peter Sutcliffe got away with their crimes for so long due to their choice of victim. And there are many more cases involving this demographic that remain unsolved. Some may say that it's police prejudice. This leads to so many unsolved murders that they don't care as much as they would if the victims were respected members of the community. But although that may be part of the case, I think there are several other reasons as well. Police prejudice may be true in certain cases. I think it's also a sign of society as a whole and how these people are viewed. You pass them every single day. There are homeless people sitting outside shops or on a park bench. There are drug addicts walking past you, especially if you live in certain areas. These are the types of people who, they're kind of invisible if you want them to be. Many, many people in society ignore them and turn a blind eye to their existence. Because if you ignore a problem, it might just go away. The problem is, nobody chooses to be a sex worker over other careers. At least the majority don't, anyway. They're usually a victim of something else, whether it be abuse, addiction, neglect, mental illness, poverty, or some other factor that forces them to sell their bodies just to survive. While it may sound like Natalie was enjoying the money she got from being a prostitute, she was 16 years old. She'd had a rough childhood, and you've got to really make sense and look at it like people may have said that she's happy and she's enjoying the money, having the time of her life or whatever, but ultimately she was still a child, just trying to find a way in the world that she had been thrust into alone at far too young an age. Like I said, the sex workers, drug addicts and people like that in the main are just ignored. I have a personal example, to be honest, from a personal point of view. There was a girl that I used to see on the streets in South East London many, many years ago. She was young, quite pretty, looked quite normal. Occasionally you'd see her on the high street asking people if they had a cigarette or some spare change or whatever, usually using the excuse she'd lost her purse or she needed money for the bus or the train home. You didn't think anything of it really, you just said no, kind of walked on, got on with your day or your evening or whatever. Within a couple of years, you'd then see her sometimes hanging about with the known drug addicts, the people we used to call the crackheads and the smackheads. They seemed to pop up in the local area like a plague at one stage, and she obviously went the same way. She had lost a shitload of weight, she got really skinny, she looked really gaunt, she had spots and scabs and stuff on her face, she had cracked lips, her teeth had gone a dark, horrible colour. She had also gone from trying to ponce a spare fag or a couple of quid to offering oral sex to random strangers for a fiver just so she could get her next fix. It was sad, but at the time people just laughed her off. Some may have taken her up on her offer, but most of us just fobbed her off, walked past, dismissed her. She became known as one of the local crack whores. Like, it's just how people view these type of people, you know? Then one day she just disappeared. No one knew where she went. No one even knew her name. And to this day, I don't know what happened to her. She could have died. She could have been arrested and sent to prison. She could have moved somewhere else. Hopefully, and looking at it with a positive viewpoint through rose-tinted glasses, she could have turned her life around. She hopefully got off the drugs, improved her health and found happiness. But we'll never know. And I'm giving this example because it's the type of person that can just disappear and nobody really cares. Or at least it seems that way anyway. Everyone just gets on with their lives and generally forgets about the homeless person, the junkie or the beggars that they pass each day. Just another inconvenience gone from their day to day. I guess a lot of these people, if they're on the streets or they're selling their bodies or whatever, they've probably used up any love that people had for them. They've done something to lose the trust of the people who have once supported and cared for them. Or they've just become a forgotten member of society. Natalie Pearman did have people who cared about her, and she still does. Yeah, they may not have always seen eye to eye. They may not have always got on. There were things that happened to her and her mum did basically kick her out, but she still loved her and she was still her daughter after all. In 2012, on the 20th anniversary of Natalie's murder, Lynn spoke to a Norfolk newspaper and she once again made a plea to catch her daughter's killer. The then 67-year-old said, quote, "I want justice for my daughter. She was 16. She was trying to earn a living the only way she could manage. She was trying to do her best to survive life. She didn't deserve what happened to her," end quote. Lynn also said that she just wanted to know what happened to her daughter, that it didn't even matter about a name now. The person who did it was irrelevant, but the reason was relevant. Hopefully one day the truth is finally found out and Natalie's family do get a little bit of closure. The case does remain open, and police believe DNA will be the key to finding out who killed Natalie eventually. DCI Andy Guy, who looks at cold cases in Norfolk, said back in December 2017, just after the 25-year anniversary of Natalie's murder, that just one piece of information could hold the key to solving this murder case. He said, quote, "There are people who know or strongly suspect who was responsible, and I'm sure that plays heavily on their conscience," end quote. There is even a chance that Natalie's killer may already be in prison for a different crime. Police in England and Wales have been able to take a DNA sample at a point where an individual has been charged with a recordable offence since 1994. In Scotland, officers have been legally allowed to obtain DNA at point of arrest since 1995, which was the same year the National DNA Database was introduced. So, if the person who had murdered Natalie was arrested before this, his DNA may never have been taken. He may have been found guilty of an offence, put in prison, and may still be there. He may have died. It's been over 30 years, so it's a massive possibility. Or he may have lived a life free, knowing that he had gotten away with murder. In April 2021, Natalie's sister Jennifer Crabtree launched a support group called Supporting Siblings Left Behind, the SSLB, which is aimed at brothers and sisters whose sibling has been murdered or committed suicide. These people, the ones who are left behind, can meet up and talk with other people who understand what they're going through. Mrs. Crabtree spoke about Natalie at the time and said that the one thing she remembered most about her sister was her amazing laugh and how she could still hear it now, which was really special to her. Then, just days before the 30th anniversary of Natalie's murder in November 2022, her other sister Georgina released never-before-seen photographs of Natalie from the family albums. This was in the hope that it helps people continue to remember her, and also for someone to finally come forward with that vital piece of information the police and family have been waiting for all these years. There is also a Facebook page dedicated to Natalie called Justice for Natalie, with regular posts urging the public to not forget about her. The photos in the album released on the 30th anniversary of her murder included Natalie as a child riding a horse, dressed in a pretty dress and with her siblings, as well as one where she was in ski boots on a set of skis in the living room of her family home. Natalie is smiling in most, if not all, of the photos released, and Georgina mentioned this, saying, quote, "For all the negativity often associated with her name over the years, Natalie is happy in these photos, and that's nice to see for me, my brothers and sister. It's also heartbreaking. Natalie was so much more than how she died," end quote. And that is something I think is really important to remember in this case. To some people, Maria was a teenage prostitute who took drugs and was a part of a society that many ignore or turn their backs on. But to her family, she was Natalie, a fun-loving, pretty, talented young woman who loved dancing and riding horses. At least one person knows the truth about what happened to Natalie, and DCI Guy reiterated this point when he said, "One call with one name could resolve this case." There is a video that was shared on a Norfolk Constabulary Facebook page with a photograph Georgina released and an actor reading out what she had said. Those words were,
"Natalie was only 16 when she died. I think people sometimes forget she was just a child. Natalie was so much more than how she died. She looks so happy in these photos, and that's really nice for us to see. But it's also heartbreaking. Every year I take my sons to Natalie's grave. They know she's their auntie. She was wonderful. But she's not here anymore. Natalie loved horses and horse riding. She was an incredibly gifted artist and a much-loved sister, daughter, and friend. Nobody can take away the 30 years of pain we've been through, but I firmly believe someone must know something. Please, if you know anything, however small or irrelevant you think it may be, please, please tell us."
Right, that wraps up another episode of Blood Runs Cold. Thank you very, very much for joining me and keeping me company, so to speak. It's been a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed the episode, were touched by it, or found out something you didn't know. I mean, it's a long shot, but maybe you're the person who has that key piece of evidence, or you know someone that does. If not about this case, about something else. Obviously, go over, give us a follow on social media. Like, comment and stuff on YouTube if you're listening or watching on there. Give us a rating on the podcast platform you're listening to. And help me to build the podcast. Help me to build it, make it bigger, and hopefully build a community of like-minded people. Anyway, thank you all again for listening. Until next time, take care, don't have nightmares, and bye-bye for now.